reading from the Epistle to the Hebrews. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old received divine approval. By faith we understand that the world was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was made out of things which do not appear. By faith Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he received approval as righteous. God bearing witness by accepting his gifts, he died, but through his faith he is still speaking. By faith Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was attested as having pleased God, and without faith it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, took heed and constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which comes by faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place which he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was to go. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city, which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even though she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants as many as the stars of heaven, and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received what was promised, but having seen it and greeted it from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Well, we continue in our Bible study in the book of Genesis. And we're creeping along. I'm going to try to blast through several chapters tonight. We'll see how far I get. And the last time we met, we talked about Adam and Eve, the garden, Adam leading to the new Adam, the old first Eve leading to the new Eve. And there are a couple of things to note about this. One is, and CJ asked me this, afterwards, he asked me about the clothing that Adam and Eve had, the animal skins that they were given by God to wear when they were cast out from the garden. And did that relate to us putting on Christ, us wearing Christ? And it absolutely does. These animals that God killed to create the skins for Adam and Eve were, in essence, the first sacrifice, the original sacrifice offered by God. And he takes these skins to clothe Adam and Eve. And that's exactly what Jesus does. He clothes us in his sacrifice so that through his passion, then we are rescued from the passion that we deserve. So absolutely, there are so many ways that we see and understand how these early chapters of Genesis are pointing us to Jesus, showing us what is to come. If we have the eyes to see it. And so now we come to this, we're going to talk about the Adam and Eve exiled and Cain and Abel, and we'll see if we manage to make it all the way to Noah tonight. If not, we'll pick that up next week. Let's talk just a little bit about dates. You know, there are those, even now, I guess there are those even now who say the earth is flat too, but there are those even now who like to date Adam and Eve to around 4 to 6,000 BC, which is not in keeping with our current scientific thought. Genetically, now this is kind of interesting. Geneticists have proven that the entire human race comes from a single family. There's actually one man and one woman from which we all genetically emanate. And geneticists date that time period to between 100,000 and 200,000 BC. Now, there's a whole lot we don't understand about the early human race. But it's interesting to me that one of the ways archaeologists determine religiosity among mankind is ritual burial. And the most ancient ritual burial spot ever found is dated right about 100,000 BC. So it's about this same time frame, about 100,000 years ago, that mankind awakened to a spiritual reality and began seeking God. Now, I'm not saying we need to take the Adam and Eve story literally, but it definitely, it is teaching us profound truth that there was a time when man lived in innocence, and then mankind grew to understand his separation from God and his need to know God. And this apparently happened, according to archaeologists and geneticists, about 100,000 BC. So much for dates. But actually, one more date I want to talk about. And again, is dealing with this question of of Adam and Eve exiled. The earliest temple ever excavated is in southern Turkey, and it's dated to 10,000 BC. Now, when I do this teaching with slideshows, I have pictures. I can't show you pictures. But when you see this ancient temple dated right at the close of the last ice age, this is very, very ancient. It's made out of stone, and it is a representation of the Garden of Eden. This ancient temple contains all these stone trees, and they carve animals onto the trees and birds into the animals on the trunk and birds in the branches of the trees. And there are two key trees in the center, and then lots of other trees around those two key trees. It's called the Göbekli Tepe, which is in your notes. So if you want to Google it and see the pictures, you can. Very, very profound that man's earliest religious expression seems to be some kind of reenactment or a recitation of this Garden of Eden story. So this is extremely, extremely ancient. I realize Bible scholars will tell you that this was written into the Bible around 1000 BC, which is true. But the story itself is much, much, much more ancient from the earliest cultures of man. One other interesting thing about the Göbekli Tepe is that in this early temple, there are no idols. So earliest man appears to have worshipped God as spirit and not as stone or clay figures. And idolatry is a step down. It's not the way man originally worshipped. That's something that came later. We can talk about the history of idolatry on another talk. It's not tonight's talk. We'll get into that when we talk about Isaiah. So Adam and Eve are exiled, and they begin to have children. They have these two sons, Cain and Abel. Now, Cain and Abel, this is a fascinating story. It's one of those stories that it has so many different levels of truth to it that, of course, we see the dissension of brothers, all right? And that is something many of us, not myself, I only had a sister, but many of us have experienced in our own family, the competition between brothers. Cain was unhappy because he perceived that Abel's sacrifice was better than his. Abel was a shepherd. He kept flocks. Cain was a farmer. And we also begin to see this this theme of conflict between those who want to follow flocks and those who want to stay put and plant crops. And this, of course, is a theme that extends all the way into the 19th century, at least, when there's conflict between the cowman and the farmer, right? Why can't the cowman and the farmer be friends? They have a whole different way of looking at their livelihood and at how to work the land. And those conflicts continue to grow. So all these different levels of which this story talks about. But one of the truths that we see in this story is that Abel's sacrifice was an animal sacrifice. He was a shepherd, and he offered a sacrifice of blood. And Cain was a farmer, and he offered a sacrifice of his produce, of his crops. Now, I don't really think that God rejected Cain's sacrifice just because it was grain, because there are lots of grain sacrifices in the Old Testament. But there is an element in which the animal sacrifice, again, is that prefigure of the sacrifice of Christ. The ultimate sacrifice was to be a blood sacrifice, the blood of Christ, which we continue to share in the Eucharist each Sunday. When every time we come to the Eucharistic table, we are sharing in Christ's sacrifice. So as a prefigure of Eucharist in Abel's sacrifice that made it special and unique. And Cain somehow perceived this. Was upset that Abel's sacrifice was better. And so God warns him, and he says, sin is couching at the door. Now, that's an odd phrase, sin is couching at the door. We don't say that too often in our everyday language. But the Hebrew word for couching, which is rabash, comes from an Akkadian word which they use to talk about a spirit. We could translate it demon, but not in the sense that we think of demons today. But a spirit, an attitude, something that can actually take over you. When you lose control into anger or resentment or jealousy, when you're no longer in control, that's what they would consider to be a spirit, that you've lost your intellect and now you're just being controlled by something that's beyond you. And so God is telling Cain not to lose control, not to be so upset that he loses control and flies into sin, which of course is exactly what he does, and then meets with Abel, his brother. They go out into a field, and that's kind of a premeditated thing. You know, Cain goes, hey, come out to the field with me. I want to show you something. They get out there, and of course he kills him. And then, which is fascinating, that the second generation, or the first generation, I guess you could say, after the fall of man becomes a murderer. And the direction of mankind is pretty much set at that point. Now, with Abel dead, Cain is the only surviving male in the family, and he runs off to create a city. Once again, we're beginning to see the cultural expression being revealed in this story. The ancient Hebrews were nomads. They followed their flocks, like Abel. They did not live in cities. Even when Israel took possession of the land and they had cities, there were always sects of righteous who would live the old way, who would live in tents and who would be nomads and refuse to live in a city. Even in Jesus' day, we still see this, not quite in the same fashion, but the Essenes, from whom John the Baptist comes, chose to live away from the city, out in the desert, out in the Negev, and to separate themselves, but not to live in city. They lived in a community, but they would not live in a city. Cities were always seen as being sinful, and the righteous life was to live in the land, following the flocks, close to the land, close to the way, close to the need for God's provision, and not where everything is kind of taken care of for you. So Cain goes and he begins a city and he has a wife. This is always one of the biggest questions that people have about the Bible. Where did Cain get his wife? I think I put that teaser in the bulletin. Obviously attracted a lot of people. Where did Cain get his wife? And the answer to that question is, we have no idea. In the Middle Ages, there's actually a Jewish midrash. Now, midrash is like a book of interpretations, and where these rabbis sit and argue about things, and they write all these different interpretations down. And there's an ancient midrash which says that Adam and Eve had two sons, but they had lots of daughters, which aren't mentioned in the Bible. And that's actually what the conflict between Cain and Abel was over one of the daughters. Well, it's an interesting story, but it really doesn't seem to apply.
Cain married his sister.
So Cain married his sister. That's what the ancient Midrash says. But the more we learn archaeologically and scientifically about early human history, the more we see that the biblical text has a great deal of truth, but of course it's clouded over hundreds of 100,000 years of being passed from word of mouth through all these generations. We now know that at this time, 100,000 years ago, there were many different types of human-like creatures. Scientists call them hominids. Not human, but human-like. And able to interbreed with humans. The most famous of these, of course, are the Neanderthals. Neanderthals were not human. They were human-like. They interbred with human. In fact, Europeans are about 4% Neanderthal genetically. Africans, only about 1 or 2% because they apparently didn't get that far south. But we begin to see that there are a great number of human-like creatures, but who are not fully human. Now, why aren't they fully human? What geneticists can tell you why they're not human, I don't know. But geneticists say they're not human. But I know this. Only humans, us, have a spiritual nature. Only humans seek God. When you look at the archaeological digs of Neanderthal man, Firensis man, Peking man, all of these different hominid creatures who were not fully human, they do not have a religion. They do not have a spiritual hunger. They do not have a spiritual nature. What sets man apart, not only from every other creature on the planet, but from all these other competitors of humankind or near humankind, all these other hominids, is that only humanity seeks God. We have a divine spark that God gave to us that The way Genesis expresses it when it talks about Adam and Eve is God breathed his spirit into mankind. And we became set apart. We became unique. Now, one of the fascinating things when you look at man from an evolutionary standpoint, quite frankly, we were smaller and not as smart as some of these other hominids. The Neanderthals were bigger than we are. They were smarter. Their technology was superior to ours, which we uncover, you know, of course, in these archaeological digs. But they disappeared. Only mankind survives. And it's not because we're bigger or smarter or faster or all those other things evolutionists like to talk about, the survival of the species, you know, the survival of the fittest. We were not the fittest. But we were chosen. And that makes all the difference. Well, I'm not going to make it to Noah, which I was afraid I wouldn't. But one other thing I want to mention before I get to the flood. I'll do the flood, which is one of my favorite stories. We'll get to the flood next week. Is the next son, Seth. Seth is Adam and Eve's third son. Of course, Abel is dead. Cain has run off to the land of Nod, living with the Neanderthals. That's my conjecture. But Seth comes. And once again, we're seeing the stage being set for the coming of the Messiah, the stage being set for Jesus. Because the one who carries the lineage of Adam and Eve forward is going to be the youngest son. And we see this theme over and over and over again through the scriptures. The older serves the younger. We see this theme again and again. Because the first Adam must serve the new Adam. Adam who's disobeyed must serve Christ, the new Adam, who lives in obedience. So Seth comes, and the youngest son is that whose lineage will carry on the spark of divinity, that's in Adam and Eve. And if you read the genealogies, I don't know how far anybody read in the Genesis as you prepared for tonight, but you read through these genealogies and you read these huge lifespans, 600 years, 700 years, 900 years. Now, one of the fascinating things about that is that if you read other accounts in this period, like the Assyrian account, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and these other accounts, the annals of the Assyrian kings, the Genesis account is very tame. Read the annals of the Assyrian kings, they live for 10,000 years, 20,000 years, 30,000 years. So it's like the author of Genesis says, well, that's ridiculous. Nobody lives 10,000 years. They couldn't have lived more than 900, you know. I don't know. We know so little about this era in human history. But there are a lot of stories, a lot of these ancient stories, which place these very, very long lifespans on early man. Did they live longer than we do? I don't know. There's a lot that we do not know. But we begin to see those lifespans come down to a more normalized span, particularly after the flood. At the flood, which we'll talk about next time, God says man will not live past 120. You know, he sets a time limit. And I haven't met anybody that's made it that far yet. But also in the biblical narrative, man was a vegetarian in this time frame. So for all of you who want to live vegetarian lives, there you go. You can live to be 900.
At least to see.
But the point to make, to understand when you're reading these early chapters of Genesis, is that it's not designed to give us a history. It's designed to begin paving the way for the Messiah. And it's amazing to me that when you have eyes to see it and you read these passages and you start seeing how they're pointing to the Messiah, that even in these stories, which date back at least 10,000 BC, because it's obvious that the Göbekli Tepe is all about the Garden of Eden, at least 10,000 BC, they're looking for the Messiah. They're expecting a Messiah. They're looking for the suffering servant who will bear passion, who will walk in obedience. These themes are already present, and we're going to see this unfold as we walk our way through the Old Testament and into the New. So if you haven't already read the first 11 chapters of Genesis, try to read those, and we'll talk about the flood a little bit next week. Okay. And now let's go to God in prayer. I have not assigned prayers to anybody, so Cheryl, would you pick that up? Because